I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a consideration of the term honor and why that concept seems to struggle for a place in the modern world. Plenty of people would probably approve of the idea of living what we would describe as an honorable life. But for some of us, the term has some serious baggage. Blood feuds, nationalism, violence against women. Well, honor is misunderstood and does matter in the modern world. That's according to my guest today, Tamler Summers. He teaches philosophy at the University of Houston. His new book is titled Why Honor Matters. Our conversation starts after this short break. It may sound old-fashioned to our ears, the concept of honor as a way to conduct one's life and understand your place in the world. Does honor still matter in the modern age, a time marked by fractured communities, rampant materialism, and a near total focus on the individual? Tamler Summers argues it's not just a nostalgic yearning for the past. He says when understood correctly and applied appropriately, honor can help us lead more meaningful, courageous lives and reduce conflicts in a range of settings, from urban school districts to the ice rink, even in our nation's criminal justice system. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. Tamler Summers is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Houston. He's the author of Why Honor Matters, and he joins us from the studios of Houston Public Media to talk about it. Tamler, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm just going to ask you the toughest question right off the top. Let's try to define what we're talking about. What is honor?
That is the toughest question. And, you know, I wrote a book on this, and I've done a bunch of these interviews, and I still don't have a great way of defining it. But with that caveat, here's the best, my best shot at giving at least an impressionistic picture of what the concept is that I'm describing. So your honor within a community is your value or worth to that community. Both your perceived worth, your perceived value, how people perceive your what people perceive your value to be, and also your actual value. It can be marked by tangible things. So, for example, when Achilles' armor was awarded to Odysseus, that marked him as the greatest warrior, the greatest contributor to the Trojan victory or upcoming victory. Or it can be marked by intangible things, being the captain of a sports team, being the comics comic in a group of comedians, and just how people treat you within the group, whether they treat you with deference, whether they treat you with contempt. So that's what, if I had to define what one's honor is, that's how I would define that. Another helpful way I think of getting at it is by looking at the differences between cultures where honor is a more is a bigger organizing principle, and cultures where we have largely rejected or abandoned honor as a guiding value. And so in honor cultures, you find a heightened concern for personal reputation and also the reputation of your group. I think everyone has some concern for it, but in honor cultures, that is a central concern. And along with that comes a heightened sensitivity to insult and to challenges for your reputation, to your reputation, to how people might perceive your value to the community. I think in honor cultures that you find a real sense of collective identification, a sense of identification with the group, and finally, greater emphasis on virtues like courage, solidarity, a sense of community, a sense of loyalty, and hospitality. That's one kind of cross-cultural norm, you find a lot that's emphasized a lot more in honor cultures than non-honor cultures.
Yeah, you do find those qualities threaded through a bunch of different groups that you talk about in your book. And I'm wondering what you think honor does for us, quote unquote, when we understand it to be operating at its best.
Well, I think honor, and for better and for worse, it is a powerful motivator. People in honor cultures have this motivational framework in place that can get them to perform risky behavior, behavior that might seem to go against their individual self-interests. Whenever you find a warrior culture, it is usually organized by principles of honor, because these people need to risk their lives. These people need to risk their safety. And so that's, I think, its greatest advantage when what people are motivated to do is a good thing. You know, so in the military is an honor culture. Many sports leagues have an honor culture, especially sports where violence plays some part in it, or putting yourself on the line, putting your physical health on the line. Honor gets us to do those things because it has this psychological power.
Now, you mentioned these honor cultures, for instance, the military, some sports teams, but they are set in a larger context because you say most of us are living in a dignity culture. What is that? What's a dignity culture?
Well, yeah, and this is not my term. I think it was originally coined by the sociologist Peter Berger. Recently, Steven Pinker has celebrated the demise of an honor culture in the West and the rise of a dignity culture. What people mean by that is a culture that is focused at the core of its morality is a respect for human rights and individual autonomy. That is the underlying philosophy of dignity cultures, that what we have to do, at least in theory, is not interfere or violate with the rights of other people and give people as much individual autonomy and freedom as it's possible to have. And of course, that's a good thing. I'm not trying to turn back the Enlightenment or reject the Enlightenment value system, but I think it isn't enough. And one of the reasons it's not enough was something I just alluded to, which is I don't think there is enough motivation in a dignity culture to perform acts of positive virtue. It doesn't take much courage not to interfere in the rights of other people or to allow them to have the individual autonomy that is celebrated in a dignity culture.
So why has honor gotten such a bad rap among some contemporary Western thinkers?
I think part of it is that it can seem quaint. You know, we think of dueling back in 18th, 19th, 17th century, and it just seems silly, you know, people slapping each other with gloves and then engaging in these duels because somebody said that they were a liar in Parliament or something like that. And then more seriously, I think you read about things like honor killings, and you read about communities where the underlying morality is a bad morality, and yet they have this powerful motivational framework in place that gets people to perform acts that we find abhorrent, like something, an honor killing of a family member because she is suspected of engaging in extramarital sex.
So there is that tension there between the dignity culture and what we perceive of honor cultures. You do write that our collective rejection of honor has caused us to lose a great deal. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the reasons we've backed away from honor, but we are also still drawn to it, is, you know, when we see mafia movies or when we read about the various dramas that go on in professional sports, or why are we so drawn to military stories? Well, people there are engaging in behavior and they're embracing personal characteristics that I think we find lacking in our own lives. A sense of community, a sense of solidarity, a sense of meaning, of living for something larger than just your own material self-interest and material safety. And so one of the things I think we've lost is this sense of community, this connection. And, you know, if there's one thing I think the last 10 years has shown is that this is something that that is really a gap, a void for many of us, and something we want to find a way to address, but we don't have the moral language or the framework in place that lets us know how to do that. I also think there's a sense of accountability. Accountability is such a strong core principle in an honor culture, and that's another thing that we find lacking in modern life. You see this kind of rampant shamelessness that has pervaded politics, that has pervaded the financial world, and that pervades many of our own lives. And we don't want the world to be like that. We don't want our own lives to be like that. But we lack this overriding organizing set of principles and values that can help bring us out of that.
Was that the driving reason why you decided to bring this book forward?
Well, I think my reasons are a little more mundane. I mean, I was always drawn to it. I did my graduate work on responsibility and free will, and sort of stumbled on research on honor cultures because I saw that they had a very different understanding of responsibility than I was used to in West and in Western philosophy in particular. And once I stumbled on that research, I found that I was just more drawn to some of these values than I thought I would be. And because I used to have the same opinion of honor as some of its critics. And so that just led me to explore it, and that led me, yeah, to propose the book. And yeah, it's in some ways a personal journey because these are things that I'm still struggling with myself.
So there are different types of honor, as you've touched on, and you know, mafia families, for instance, those also serving in a branch of the armed services like the Marines, all of them would claim that they're operating according to an honor code. You know, tell us, besides the uniforms, what is the difference
between the honor code of the mafia and the honor of, say, hockey teams or
yeah,
football
for
teams?
Example, or, you know, a branch of the armed services
or a branch of the armed services? Well, the biggest difference, I think there's a lot more similarities than there are differences. This idea that you handle your own business. If somebody gets one of your people, you have to get one of their people. You find that in sports, maybe a little less in the military. You certainly find it in the mafia. This code, the omerta, the code of silence, that you handle all your conflicts in-house. Again, that you find that across all of those domains. The biggest difference is that they are geared, all of these honor systems, towards accomplishing different things. In the military, it's accomplishing military goals. So that's what you acquire honor for. That's how honor is allocated, based on how much you contribute to that goal. In sports, it's winning the games and being a championship team. And in the mafia, it is acquiring as much power in organized crime as you can. Those are the three different goals, and so how honor is allocated depends on how well you can contribute to those goals.
This is Think from KERA. Our guest today is Tamler Summers, who teaches philosophy at the University of Houston. His new book is called Why Honor Matters. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd, and we're going to be back right after this short break. Think from KERA. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Tamler Summers from the University of Houston, whose new book is called Why Honor Matters. You can join our conversation about honor, what it looks like, and ask your question by calling 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. Do you remember that scene from The Godfather, the one where Sonny Corleone goes to his sister Connie's apartment and sees that she's been beaten up by her husband Carlo?
It was my fault!
Where is
Sonny, please? It was my fault. Sonny, it was my fault. I hit him. I started a fight with him. Please, Sonny. I hit him. So he hit me.
Okay, I'm just going to give the doctor to come take a look at you.
Sonny, right? Please don't do anything. Please don't do it.
What's the matter with you? What am I going to do? I'm going to make that baby an orphan before he's born.
And then Sonny tracks Carlo down on the street.
Come here.
Remember, he runs out of the car, throws the stick at him, and then beats him up. Beats him up with his shoe, with the lid of the garbage can, dumps the garbage can on his head. And then when Carlo is lying out on the street with a water hydrant spraying all over the place, Sonny says to him,
"Touch my sister again, I'll kill you.
You touch my sister again, I'll kill you." Tamler, it's one of the most famous scenes from that movie. It's one people love and they talk about it. Why?
Yeah, I lead off the book with it. Also, kind of betting that Sonny is going to be the reader's favorite character in The Godfather. And I think what's fascinating about Sonny, why we're drawn to him, is that just instinctive loyalty to his family, right? He doesn't think about whether it's the wise or prudent thing to do. Mm-hmm. If he finds out that his sister is being beaten by her deadbeat husband, he's going to take care of it. He's going to try to make sure that it never happens again. And whatever risks he might take, it doesn't matter. That's not the point. And that ends up getting him killed. That he and they use that against him. They use his loyalty and his passionate regard for protecting his family against him, and that's why he gets gunned down at the toll booth. But I also think it's why we like Sonny so much. I mean, obviously James Caan is a charismatic actor, but just that character seems so much more at times appealing to us than the far more calculating
Michael.
Character of Michael.
Yeah. Tamler, I just want to say, for the record, I enjoy the Godfather movies. But when I see that scene where Sonny beats up Carlo because he dared raise a hand to Sonny's sister, I can easily see that being flipped and that violence being taken out on Connie if she had somehow in some way dared to sully the family honor. And that is not an acceptable, that's not an acceptable frame of mind in this time.
Really? So you think that Sonny could have hurt Connie if he thought that Connie had done something to betray the honor of the family or something like that?
Well, it makes me wonder about the pervasiveness of violence in that world. And you have, I think you have a frame for it, contained honor and uncontained honor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about honor cultures typically being more violent. Now, I think the reasons for that are complicated. One of the reasons is that violent behavior is inherently more risky. And again, honor is a great way of motivating people to take risks. But it is also a reason why the kind of honor that I argue for, as you say, is a contained honor rather than an honor that we just let run wild because the violence can get out of control. I mean, the whole idea of blood feuds, cycles of violence, these typically happen in honor cultures, and that's why there needs to be some sort of containment on the threat of escalating violence that can get out of control. And that's what sports teams have. There is a great sense of contained violence within the sports. Hockey has fights, but those fights are contained within the rink and presided over by hockey officials using discretion to determine when they need to break in. But, you know, the mafia doesn't have that, or at least it doesn't have it at an institutional level. They have to do it internally with their own forms of mediation.
Well, I grew up watching hockey games in Canada, and back in the day, it was not an unusual thing for a couple of players to drop their gloves and start punching each other, often more than once in a game. And often, even though I was watching the game, I had no idea what they were fighting about. What would I have missed?
Well, yeah, the fighting is complicated. It involves usually a fight will be spurred on because one of the players on the opposing team took a cheap shot on a teammate of the person who now, the enforcer, who now feels like they have to challenge either the other enforcer or the person who took the cheap shot to a fight to hold him to account. That is... again, that's a guiding principle of an honor culture, that if somebody takes a shot at one of your teammates, they have to pay for it. And hockey players have a group of people whose role it is to protect the players who are more skilled at scoring goals and winning games.
That role is understood, and teams recruit for that role, and there's mutual respect among all the players. When it comes to
they're
roles.
Often the most popular teammates on the team, even though they rarely score a goal, but they make it possible. Their presence make it possible for the skill players to do their thing.
Can you tell us the story about when the National Hockey League tried to reduce the number of fights? They put in place what I think was called the instigator rule, and this might have been in 1992, and it was not popular in the hockey world. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so hockey brawls can get out of control. There's a great one in my hometown of Boston, Montreal. If you look at the brawl in the hall, It is, I mean, it's famous, but it's not a sustainable way for a hockey professional league to function. And one of the things the league has to do is make sure that the police don't get involved. So with brawls getting out of control and with this whole series of players called goons who could barely skate, but their goal was just to intimidate their opponents. Hockey thought, well, we're going to give more of a penalty for starting a fight. And this was the instigator rule, that if you started a fight, that would be an automatic 2-minute penalty. And the goal there was to reduce the number of fights, not to eliminate them, but to reduce them.
And what
happened? The goal was to make it a less violent game, but some of the players think it had the opposite effect. It made it a more violent game because now opposing players could take those cheap shots, the agitators, that's another kind of hockey player, an agitator whose goal it is to get into the heads of their opponents. They could take these cheap shots, and it was too costly to hold them to account by fighting them. And so the players thought this is going to lead to more injuries and more violence now that the instigator rule is in place and fighting is, there's less of an incentive to fight.
So how did the league end up handling the instigator rule? What happened to it?
I think it's still in place, as far as I know, and still hotly debated. You know, this is a great thing about honor cultures, is you have this evolving norms and a lively debate about how they're evolving. But I think the way hockey is moving right now is still trying to eliminate or reduce the amount of fighting that goes on. And although the diehard fans and the hockey players themselves resist it, there is pressure from outside to make that happen. I can't pretend to be a hockey expert, so I don't know how that's going to turn out. But I think that's the way it's heading right now.
Sure. Well, you also mentioned the referees and the role that they play on the ice. And they are considered respected members of that community, even though they're not on the teams, but they're providing a service there, so to speak. Their role as guardrails, is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, guardrails and psychologists, you know, they know what's going on. One of the great things about hockey as an honor culture and honor cultures in general is officials are permitted to use, the people who are presiding are permitted to use a lot more discretion and to really notice the particular elements of a conflict. And so a hockey official, if he sees a fight going on and realizes that something has to get resolved here for the game to become more peaceful, he will let it happen. He will tell the players what they need to hear so that they can save face for when they go back to their own bench. And it's really beautiful. There's a great book called The Code, I think, by Ross Bernstein that I turned to for a lot of fascinating stories. And one of the things, the officials are what makes the game fun and what makes the game work, although you'd never know it just by watching the games. You never know how close their relationship is with the players and how involved they are in guiding the action and even the fighting.
Tanler Summers is our guest today. He teaches philosophy at the University of Houston, and his book is titled excuse me, Why Honor Matters. If you want to join our conversation, you are most welcome. The number is 800-933-5372. Once again, that's 800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Well, speaking of sports, it does remind me, you know, youth sports are huge. And so when families are putting their children into sports leagues, they need to learn the rules and how it operates. Do you find, is there a tension between what parents' expectations are and the sports, the cultures around the sports that they're putting their kids into?
You know, it's funny. I think one of the things that make me hopeful is that about honor making a comeback is that once you're put in an environment where those values become conducive and people have the opportunity to behave in ways that seem honorable and to embrace the virtues and values of honor cultures, they seem to naturally adapt. And I think, you know, you look at parents, even the parents who are ardently opposed in theory to the honor, you know, honor cultures and honor as a guiding principle, once their kid is in a sports league and the coach is instilling these values into them, the parents, as far as I can tell, seem to embrace it. Now, my experience personally is a daughter on a fourth and fifth grade basketball team that was terrible, that went 0-12 both years. But there was a lot of honor drama in all of those games, even for such low stakes. And from what I hear and from what I've read, that continues at much higher levels too.
You mentioned drama, and that does seem to be a feature of honor cultures, whether they're contained or uncontained. Where does the sense of drama come from?
Well, I think when you're, the very core of your identity is at stake, which in a conflict within an honor culture, you know, who you are is so wrapped up in your honor and your reputation that just is inherently dramatic. That's why so many of our most famous stories are honor stories, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Greek dramas, the Greek tragedies, Shakespeare. So much of Shakespeare revolves around honor. And it's because people are, the stakes couldn't be higher. It's who you are that is being debated. It's who you are that's being tested. And how that comes out will have a big change as to how you're perceived and how you perceive yourself.
And you write that even if the outcome isn't what it turns out to be what you were hoping for, just the fact that you take the stand, that seems to be where most of the emphasis is.
Yes. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a big sort of misunderstanding, I think, about honor cultures, and especially ones that involve fighting and violence. Often what it doesn't matter whether you win or you lose the fight. What matters is that you show up, that you show heart. And if you lose, well, that's okay, because you proved that you're willing to take it. And by doing so, you've earned the respect of your own group and often the opposing group as well.
I want to make sure we have a chance to touch on an issue that you raise in the book that's clearly important to you. Around restorative justice. And we have about 2.3 million people incarcerated in this country. And you make the case for investing in restorative justice, a concept that you say is rooted in an honor-based approach as a way to address criminal justice reform.
Yeah, this is probably the thing I'm most excited about in the book, something I want to pursue in future research. Restorative justice is an exciting movement in criminal justice and punishment systems more generally. Its basic core principle is that when there is a conflict, including a criminal conflict, that the goal that we should have isn't to give the offender the punishment that they deserve, the punishment that is proportionate in some sense, in some ideal sense, to their culpability. The goal is to resolve the conflict between the relevant parties, for the offender to make it right to the victim. And restorative justice brings the offender and the victim together, family members and other relevant members of the community, in an attempt to try to sort out what is the best way that we can address what happened, restoring respect to the victim, and after that occurs, providing an avenue for the offender to be reintegrated within the community. And when it works, it's beautiful. It is exciting. It's a huge explosion of popularity within the schools. It's making headway in juvenile courts.
Sorry, we're going to have to take a quick break, because we are listening to Think right here on KERA. We'll be right back in a moment. From KERA, this is Think. I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. And we are speaking with Tamler Summers, the author of Why Honor Matters. If you've got a question for Tamler, give us a call at 800-933-5372. You can always email us at think@kera.org. Tamler, just to get back to the issue of restorative justice, that approach has been supported by folks on the left as well as the right. Why? What is it about it that draws support from across the political spectrum?
Well, I think on the right, I think that this idea that the people who are involved in a conflict are the ones that address the conflict themselves without or with minimal government interference. That is appealing. The right tends to be suspicious of too much interference from a centralized government. I think the left like it because it typically leads to a reduction in sentences for criminals and a way of addressing criminal justice reform. It also allows certain values like empathy and taking responsibility to come out within a conflict. And that's something I think people on the left and the right can embrace. I think it is something that when people really read about it or experience it, is something that no matter what your political orientation, you will find it appealing and, in a way, kind of morally beautiful that surprises you.
We're going to head to the phones now. And Steve in Dallas, thanks for giving us a call today.
Hi, yeah, I enjoyed the discussion. I guess one thing I wanted to ask about is that in spite of some of the admirable things you say about honor cultures, it seems like even things like the military and the police often have a kind of code of silence, kind of like the mob, and that things like My Lai and Abu Ghraib in the military, or if you remember the movie Serpico, there's often a code of silence when there's wrongdoing in something like the police, and it seems as though that's kind of connected to the honor culture and makes it sort of hard to break up kind of criminal activity and other wrongdoing within them.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and it's probably something I underemphasize also in the book. So take the example with the police, Serpico. I mean, we see this today, this code of silence, the blue line. I think in that case, part of the problem is that there isn't as much self-policing as there should be within an honor culture. So you're absolutely right that there is this code of silence, and nobody likes outside interference in a personal affair. But what you don't seem to have is a sense of accountability often within police culture, or at least this is how it looks from the outside. When somebody engages in police brutality or police misconduct, the group doesn't take that as this is damaging the reputation of the group and we have to handle this ourselves. We have to take great steps to make sure this doesn't happen. There's often just too much emphasis on making sure that that person doesn't get punished either from outside or from inside. And when honor cultures are well functioning, when they work well, you find that self-policing that you sometimes don't find in the cases that you bring up. Not always, but sometimes.
Tamler, we got an email comment and question from Richard, and Richard says, honor cultures in the West usually exist in groups that have a strong sense of otherness and even estrangement from the broader culture. Would you agree? I do have to say that maybe Richard is not referring to, for instance, the military or the police in that circumstance.
Yeah, certainly I think that's right. A group that seems beleaguered, that seems like the world is against them, they typically turn to honor as a way of combating that. This is why I think oppressed groups often use honor. One of the things that I was surprised to find in my research is how big a role honor has played in things like civil rights, the civil rights movement, Zionism back in the 19th century, and also even in the women's rights, women's voting. Many of them turn to honor as a way of motivating people and a way of organizing people to battle the oppression that they were experiencing. And this is something that even in sports teams, you see played up, this idea of it's us against the world. Everybody's against us. Everybody doubts us. So we have to band together and come together as a group and be even more excellent because everybody is opposed to us.
Well, let me ask you about women and how they interpret honor. You just mentioned maybe a historical example. I don't know, were you referring to the battle over suffrage and the women's vote? I mean, whenever it was, how did women use honor as a way for them to achieve their goals?
Well, women historically and today play a big role in honor cultures. It's not the same role as men, but it is a big role in terms of transmitting the norms and often motivating the men to behave in honorable ways and shaming them when they don't. Now, in that, I'm referring there to a book, Liberalism with Honor, by, God, I'm blanking on the name right now, but it's a book, it's a really good book called Liberalism with Honor, and she talks about the women's suffrage movement and how the women emphasized the need for accountability and standing up and taking risks, either political risks or risks within their community, to fight for this principle that women should have the right to vote, and in doing so, appealed to the honor of women as a way of bringing them together and acquiring that right.
Tamler, in the book, you spell out that you identify politically often as a liberal. Why did you feel that was important to bring up?
I just felt, and this is, I think, turned out to be true to some degree, that people were going to think I had a political agenda in writing this book, and I really didn't. So I just wanted to lay my cards out on the table at the outset of the book, saying, look, I'm liberal, probably not as liberal as many academics, most academics that I know, but that's my politics. But the politics of honor are all over the spectrum, and I am not trying to accomplish a partisan goal in writing this book. I mean, to the extent that I would want to accomplish a political goal, it would be something like instituting restorative justice or trying to institute it within our larger system. But as you said earlier, that's something that people on the right and the left often embrace.
How do you see our different understandings of honor playing out in our national life right now? I mean, how do you see the concept of honor, the way it's represented or it's understood in red states, and how does it look in blue states?
Well, there was a book by Richard Nisbet and Dove Cohen called Culture of Honor that's a inspirational book, one of the first books that I'm familiar with in cultural psychology that really focused on honor in America. And what it argued is that people in the Southeast, which are almost entirely red states, tend to embrace honor values because they're descendants of the Scotch-Irish herders in that 16th, 17th century, and herding cultures tended to be honor cultures. So the people in those states have inherited those norms and practices. And I think that's true to some degree, but unfortunately what's been lost is this sense of community. Or at least it's been lost to a considerable degree. So you still have the heightened sensitivity to insult, the disposition to act violently when you are insulted or challenged, but there, in many cases, there's not enough of a larger community that can help to restrain the passions of people and help give them a guiding purpose or a guiding sense of who they are and what they want to identify as.
And how do you see it playing and being interpreted in blue states?
I think you see it often treated with contempt in blue states. I know that, when I talk to a lot of my friends in the Northeast, which is they tend to roll their eyes when I talk about honor, or they tend to get on their high horse and say that we're so happy to have moved past those barbaric values that you are giving a qualified defense of. And yet I do think in smaller environments, in smaller contexts, those honor values will come out. So I think when they, when they're on the basketball court playing a pickup game, or when their kid is in a soccer game, a lot of those same values come out and those same behaviors, but they probably won't be as likely to admit it, or maybe they'll feel, if pressed, ashamed of it.
I have conversations with people all the time, and I hear from a lot of them about the anxiety they're feeling about the crisis of leadership that they perceive we're having right now in our institutions, in our civic life. I'm wondering how you think our notions of honor feed into what we expect from our leaders.
Yeah, if there's one thing where honor seems to be completely absent. It's in political leadership, again, on both sides. Our current president, I think, is characterized by a kind of shamelessness. But it's not just him. I mean, everybody seems like their goal, it's a bunch of Michaels, right? They are
Michael Corleone.
Yeah, Michael Corleone is exactly. Like, their goal is just instrumental to achieve a certain end, and they will never sacrifice their political self-interest to stand on principle. Ted Cruz endorsed Trump after Trump said his wife was ugly and that his father killed JFK. I mean, you know, this is something in an honor culture that nobody could ever do. So I think one of the things that we find so alienating about politics is how completely those values are rejected and that nobody even has the expectation that they will be lived up to any longer because nobody on either side seems to display them. Not nobody, but so few people seem to display them.
Have you studied a community or a culture where honor norms fell apart, kind of in the way that you're describing, but somehow the community was able to pull it back together and form new norms, healthier norms?
No, not a particular culture.
Tamler, that's depressing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, And I think one of the reasons is that we, as the way modern life has progressed, it's become more anonymous. We've retreated to our citadels. We're more isolated. And honor needs a community. And as the communities disappear, then the opportunities for expressing these virtues and values associated with honor, they also disappear. But I think where they'll make a comeback is not at the national level. I can't say I'm optimistic that they'll make a comeback in politics, but at more local levels, within neighborhoods, within communities, within schools, within sports teams, within the various groups that we can try to form. And if we can figure out a way to strengthen those local communities, then that is a fertile ground for honor to flourish.
And online, on social media, do you see any hope there?
No. Pretty much no. I mean, social media is a place where you can do things that are, you know, that people in honor cultures do, like insult people, challenge them, challenge their reputation. But there's no consequences to that. In an honor culture, if you insult somebody, you know, you might have to stand up and fight them or duel them or something. But here, nobody knows who you are, and so there's no risk involved. And that is not a recipe for a flourishing honor culture.
Well, Tamler Summers, it has been a treat. Thank you for being with us here on Think.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Tamler Summers teaches philosophy at the University of Houston. His new book is called Why Honor Matters. And this is Think from KERA in Dallas. I'm Kim Malcolm. I'm in for Chris Boyd. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts was our engineer today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. I'm Kim Malcolm. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.